Today's episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Our Fair City is sponsored by Cards Against Humanity. They asked us not to read an ad. Please enjoy the show. Loyal Policies, this is HeartLife NFP executive producer Jeffrey Gardner. We're back with another episode of Listener Questions. Thank you so much to everyone who sent questions in. If you think of something else you want to ask us, remember we'll always answer them through social media. We're on Twitter at OFC Radio, or on Tumblr at theboardofdirectorslovesyou.tumblr.com. Please also consider making a pledge to our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/heartlifeNFP. Pledging gets you access to monthly Our Fair City themed playlists by DJ Catnip, along with other great rewards. Today, we'd like to give a special shout out to one of our backers, Stacy Looney. Stacy, in recognition of your contributions to the company, you've been granted an additional 15 pitchin' by snitchin' points, redeemable for your favorite Archibald Funny Pants Variety Hour souvenirs. Keep reporting disloyalty in your fellow policies, and good luck. Thank you all so much for listening, and as always, we'll see you in the tunnels.
Prunella Modularis, I'm going to say Prunella, on Tumblr asked us about, was very excited that we're doing this, so thanks everybody for being here, that's awesome. And wanted to ask for recommendations, right? So, like, if you like Our Fair City, and we're all really into this, what are cast and crew favorite novels and comics? What do you love to read in your spare time?
In far as comics alone, if we're sticking straight to comics, great one. If you're into, like, sort of, like, offbeat, really good, Orion.
Who's that by?
I don't remember the man's name, but it's the same person who writes Ghost in the Shell, okay. Who wrote Ghost in the Shell. And then other one on my totally, I do like a lot of like weird, you know, weirder comics. There's one that I've been wanting to follow for a long time. I picked it up in a 25-cent bin. And I've contemplated getting the trades online, but, you know, laziness and like, when am I going to read this, et cetera, all the other reasons I haven't, you know, watched Citizen Kane or read all sorts of other things that I haven't read. It's called Thieves and Kings. It's by a like Canadian indie publisher dude. It's kind of has a weird, like, not something I totally normally dig. Like, it's very like feel good, like kidsy, like, you know, it makes me feel very innocent in a way, which is something I like a lot about it. And also something that I normally don't search out or like seek out in comics.
If you like Our Fair City, if you love Our Fair City and you're looking for similar materials to check out, I think one of the best books I've read in a very long time was Station 11.
Oh my God, that was mine too.
Oh,
that book is so good.
I was happy.
It's so good.
Did you bring it for me?
I've totally forgot. No! I'm sorry, Jeffrey. It's so good.
Yes, one of the things that I love about Our Fair City and sci-fi storytelling in general, I'm a big apocalypse junkie. I love exploring the hows and whys of what ends a civilization and then forces us to examine what parts of that civilization we care enough about maintaining. And Station 11 handles all of these things in really beautiful, elegiac kind of ways. The character development is really rich, and the pop culture that it's based on is really engrossing. And you see a lot of the whys of what this MacGuffin story, within the story that is carried through, and its significance to the different people, the different survivors, in a way that I find really heart-wrenching.
Is it a comic or
a novel?
It's a novel.
It's a novel. Yeah.
Is it an adult novel?
It's an adult novel, definitely. The thing I always say, I often tell people about Station Eleven, is that it is a piece of post-apocalyptic writing that still manages to have a really positive point of view about humans and like who we are as people, that ultimately the people in this story want good. They want to live, they want to love, they want to make things, like some terrifying things happen in it, but ultimately, like, the people are people that at the end I go, like, yeah, that's what people are like.
Those are the ones that we have to live for. Those are the ones that are going to help us persevere, kind of like in that classic Chekhovian kind of way where we're all working for the betterment of the generations coming after us. Another one is, I love Snowpiercer. I love it so much in the movie format. And also it was originally a French graphic novel from the early 80s. It has two big ass trade paperbacks that you can find in hardcover. They're so pretty. And a third one came out like in the past 2 years or so. Yeah, I think as a result of the film.
Anything by Mobius.
Yes. And that has a lot of trappings that are reminiscent to OFC, I think, but are still like very much of its own right. The movie is action-tastic, and the graphic novel is very introspective. And so if you get both of them, then...
Oh, and Chris's beard.
Oh, and Chris's beard.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah. The movie's real fun. But there's a part I can't watch.
Yeah.
Let's see. Also, piggyback a little bit on Station 11, if I'm just going to do post-apocalyptic stuff real quick, because that's also like OFC. If you live in an area that has a strong theater scene, or if you're a theater person, and if you read scripts, I would recommend you read or see, if you ever have an opportunity to, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play.
I'm going to second that.
Has very similar
structure
and
sense
to Station 11.
Yep.
But it is based on a small group of people having survived a cataclysmic event that are keeping themselves warm and safe and comforted by retelling, in this world that has no electricity, retelling the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons. And it's a wonderful meditation on the necessity for storytelling and how those needs change for different cultures over an elapsed period of time, too.
It's so brilliant.
It's so smart, and it's really, it's very emotional. Also, Wool.
Comic-wise, anything by Mike Mignola, who does Hellboy. So the Hellboy, the Baltimore series, the Witchfinder series, they're all basically gothic horror, which is my jam. Book-wise, I have a lot of Terry Pratchett. I have most of Terry Pratchett. You might be able to tell that. That's why I'm on the Animaniacs side of the rope. The Lady Trent series by Marie Brennan, which is a Victorian woman who studies dragons, is really good. And then my two favorite books are Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and The Night Circus, which are very similar.
Both of those are on my list of media I haven't
really
gotten to yet.
I also feel like this is an appropriate moment to mention, for anyone listening who doesn't know, that Jim wrote a book. It's
really good.
It's really, I feel like, quite entertaining. People should know that.
Yeah, aren't you the plug guy? Weren't you talking about plugs?
So Jim,
first Google plugs, plug yourself.
For other people.
So Jim wrote a book called The Unattractive Vampire. Did I get that right?
An unattractive vampire.
That's sorry.
That's a lot of pressure to put on one unattractive vampire.
My bad. And it's sitting on my table right now.
And it's available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah,
and you can get it on Audible.
Is it an audiobook? Yeah.
That's how you plug it. There we go. All right, Marcia, how about you?
Also, in the vein of post-apocalyptic literature, one of my favorite books in the whole world that I recommend to everybody, and I recommend to two people in this room, but I think you'd already read it, is The Gone Away World by Nick Harkaway. Oh, it is
this
so good.
This book is so good.
I forgot to mention webcomic.
It is post-apocalyptic, although we sort of start at the end and come back and go through the apocalypse. It is funny. It is silly funny sometimes, but it is very dark. It does some really interesting things narratively and has some like...
It has such a good twist.
It has a great twist. It has a thing like... There's a thing at the beginning that I go, huh, I guess I'm never going to know the answer to this thing. So I'm just going to decide that that's not important. And then later I'm like, oh, that actually, in fact, is very important and is the key to everything. I don't think that was a spoiler. The other thing, I just read, I'm working on a theatrical production of A Wrinkle in Time right now. And when I was a kid, I sort of conflated Ursula K. Le Guin and Madeleine L'Engle, I think because of the le part.
Yeah, I can see that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But so I just read Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, which I'd never read. I'd never actually finished any of her
work. Any of her stuff?
Yeah.
Earthsea Quintet's good, too.
Yeah. I think I tried to read Wizard of Earthsea when I was a youth and failed to finish it. But this was fascinating. It has a lot... it was written in the 60s, but it has a unique approach to gender. It's set on another planet where human beings evolved differently as far as gender and sexuality goes. And so while in some ways it's written with the trappings of the 60s, it's also very, very current and very interesting to in the way it approaches gender and sexuality. And it's also about all kinds of other things, but that's The Left Hand of Darkness that I just finished. Those are my things. All right, Jeffrey, what about you?
So, for early inspiration for Our Fair City, one of the big ones is Brazil.
Oh yeah,
which is like if you want to get how I have always pictured the Tower and the Tunnels, watch Brazil. It's an amazing piece of film. It's heartbreaking and awful. Terry Gilliam. And, you know, to in an interesting kind of separate way, a lot of 12 Monkeys, which he made later, also plays into our Fair City's aesthetic. Lately, I have been devouring N.K. Jemisin's work, she has these amazing novels. The Fifth Season, her first book, The 100,000 Kingdoms. Really, really cool. Thank you, Eleanor.
Yeah, I read 100,000 Kingdoms. So good.
I think you lent that to me.
Yeah, I think I did.
For comics, I love Saga, of course. The Wiccan Divine. A thing to find. It was originally a webcomic, but was published in a full like omnibus edition. Is Digger.
I was going to throw that out there because I'm currently reading Digger because you recommended it to me.
I will let you talk about it.
So it is in the protagonist is an anthropomorphized wombat. Remember that? Right? Yeah, wombat who finds herself comes out the other end of a tunnel and finds herself in a land that she doesn't recognize, where there's gods and trouble and. Kind of gets into a bunch of trouble that she doesn't want to be part of. She's like, I just want to go home and can't get home. It's really fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. It's really fun to watch this protagonist who is so kind of otherworldly in the role of like straight man, so to speak, of like, dealing with like, what's happened? Why am I what's this? Why do I have to deal with this? It's great. It's really fun. I'm really enjoying it. She's the reader stand-in, even though like her point of view makes very little sense to me.
Bone.
Yeah. Bone is wonderful.
Too. Yeah. So yes, Digger. I'm really enjoying that. I'm like 3/4 of the way through.
Do you want to continue?
All mine got said.
Okay. For a graphic novel series, Lock and Key. Written by Joe Hill, illustrated by Gabe Rodriguez. It's wonderful, beautiful world building. It's really evocative work. The concept is that this family has moved into the key house on Lovecraft Island, and the keys can be are accessible to the teenagers, but not to the adults in the family. And the keys don't just open doors, or they don't just open doors that go into other rooms. Because if you open a door using one key, and you try to step through it, you fall down, quote unquote, dead, and your spirit goes through that door, and then you can be a ghost until you get back to your body. There's another door that you can open and turn into your natural Patronus or animal form. It's all these really wonderful parallels to how it feels to be taking on, like, it feels a lot like, it's very reminiscent of what it is to go through puberty and, like, the different, like, ideas of yourself and reconciling who you are with who you want to be and, like, forms of escapism in that way. It's really interesting, and also there's an overarching mythology to the keys that is really dark and engrossing. So totally check that out. It's the series is complete, but, you know, Joe Hill's Stephen King's son, so he's never really going to entirely walk away from a property, so he's probably going to, like, add little dibs and dabs to it, like, in perpetuity. But there is a complete story that you can absorb at this point, and it's fascinating. The other thing is Margaret Atwood. But everyone who listens to OFC...
definitely read Margaret
Thank you
Atwood.
So much, and everyone that wants to be a creator as well, you can... only make yourself a better creator if you're reading and absorbing other people's art that you are passionate about. And so thank you so much as one of the people that has helped you bring you OFC for helping us make this happen.
Vrak on Tumblr asks, on an entirely shameless fanish note, am I the only one who's been increasingly expecting Monty and Herbert to smooch this season?
Well, now I am.
That's a yes
there
from Catnip.
There are lots of pleased smiles around the room.
Yes. That should happen.
Okay, great. Soap Lady asks, chai or spicy hot chocolate, which is better on a cold Chicago morning around the circle?
Chai.
If you can get decaf chai, by far chai.
I don't even know what chai is, so hot chocolate.
Oh, goodness. No, you have to mix those two. Mm. Clearly. Oh. Clearly.
Well, given the choice, the answer is always chocolate.
But now I want to try it mixed with hot chocolate.
I'm going to go with spicy hot chocolate. But that was definitely, if this was like an election, I think chai would have won. All right. Question. Snail Army asks, serious production question, because I'm a curious bird. Do you have any regrets vis-a-vis the audio drama you've produced so far? Things you wish you'd done, not done, or done differently? Who's got thoughts? I feel like everybody in this, like a lot of you in this room have very different perspectives on the making of the work, so you might have different, very different answers for this.
I mean, I have very specific answers.
Go for it, Jim.
I think, and Jeffrey can talk a little bit more to this, a lot of season one, there's a reason we went back and did a remastered version, is that we wanted to put sort of our best foot forward, and we realized that people starting off are starting off with probably our weakest stuff. So there's some of that. I know specifically for me, I can't listen to Tunnel Collapse anymore because there's some very... Now, being several years after that, having written that, there are things that I'm aware of now that I'm like, oh, that's icky. That's problematic. I shouldn't have written that. If I could, I would go back and rewrite that episode, Jeffrey. And there are bits and pieces here and there that I can go back to, like, decisions where I'm like, I wish this bit would have gone into it. There's also the robot apocalypse that I had planned. So those are mine.
Save that on the shelf for later.
Mm-hmm. I have three. I don't want to harp too much on Cassie, but I did, when I was making peace with her having been killed off as a character, I did mourn what I had hoped could become of her character. I've always looked longingly at the Science family and thought, that could have been me. Or imagined the wedding that Aww. She and Snidge would have had at the end of one of the next seasons, and the exploration of what love-based commitment ceremonies would be like sociologically and culturally in Heart Life, whether or not those were something that people were allowed to have or had to be, like, done speakeasy style, like, under the radar, so the higher-ups didn't find out.
Tumblr, fan art, please, and... And Ellie, you just killed half of the audience just now. You just broke their hearts.
Everybody's like,
what do I do? Yeah.
It's so sad.
I was just excited for her to have more arc that didn't come from her getting shoved out of 50-floor window.
Yeah. But I think it's so beautiful. I don't want to stop you talking, but like I think and maybe this is just my cold Caligari heart coming through, but there's something so beautiful that she just died.
I know.
And she's not being like brought back, becoming like some shadow of her former self or some pale imitation, that she will always be like young and beautiful and strong and brave and all of those things, and she will never be crawling on a little spider body.
It also speaks to something about this world and this universe, that death is real. Because especially when we have characters like Andrew who are like coming back all the time.
Right.
That,
or Elizabeth too.
Yeah. Exactly. But it speaks to the fact that in this reality, like death is a real thing. Anyway. Even when you're not killed by Chamberlain.
The next one would be that I never got to voice a mole person. And the third one would be if we were still writing one-offs or fringe shows, the ideas that I had always nursed after the first one would be either a mole sitcom or an immersive experience that was a Heart Life produced cooking show.
You know, regrets is a really hard thing to think about in this context, because there are definitely pieces of the show that I look back on and I think, wow, I sure was, you know, what, 23, 22 when we started this project? Like, no, I wasn't 22. I was young, though. Like,
you're on my age, aren't you?
Something like that. Anyway, like, very young when I started that, and like, that shows through. And I'm like, wow, you know, I have learned so much about different people. I've learned so much about myself. And, you know, like, many of the things that I was trying to say, I was not able to at that point. I'm not able to say clearly because of, you know, inherent biases that I hadn't figured out, or just, like, you know, cultural stuff bouncing around.
I can chime in a little bit here. I am super, let me just premise this, that I'm super pleased. I've been very happy with my involvement in the show. So I don't want this to sound like I'm crabbing, because I'm not. I have been super, super pleased with watching the arc of the show grow, and mainly because of fan feedback and sort of like the great people that I work with. Like, I'm really happy to always come back to the recording studio and come back to the table reads. But I kind of think, like, my one sort of regret was there was a time when I was a writer for the show, and we had talked about, like, I had told Jeff, like, well, you know, yeah, I get it. I'd rather be an actor than a writer. And, you know, that's still pretty much true. You know, that's still mostly true. I mean, let's be honest. In a perfect world, I would be a writer and an actor and a, you know, a sculptor and, you know, insert everything else, you know, a scientist and an astronaut. But, you know, realistically, but I very, very, very early on, in the very beginnings of the show, I had had a story arc and a script where Caligari was a very different character when Caligari was first written. Caligari was sort of like a corporate doctor that was, well, I guess sort of in a similar way, who was sort of like, oh, yeah, I didn't really buy the corporate thing. But Caligari had a assignment from the corporation, which was to be the personal doctor for a leader of a cult. And the cult was this fringe thing that the company like allowed to exist because it was because the guy who was the leader of the cult was someone like West, who had been around since
Lazarus.
Yeah, he'd been around since before the time. The company kept him around because he was old. And he remembered the time before, and he wrote the company book on indoctrination and like mind control. So the company kept him alive because they wanted to get that information out of him. But he was a horrible person. Caligari hated him more than anyone else, and he basically like kept a cult around just to grow organs for him, because every couple of years something would fail on him, and he had blah 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 blah, and someone had to get murdered so that he could harvest their organs, or maybe not murdered if he was just harvesting their eyes, or their whatever.
Was it sister?
Sister, yeah.
Sister what? Sister Sarah.
Sister Sarah the Sightless,
who did the propaganda.
Yeah, she did the propaganda for them. But I had written this whole arc that, and it comes up. There are one or two references to it that are really obscure.
I can name them.
Well, of course you can name them. You're a writer.
The reference to Near St. Nick.
Yep.
Very early on, the Mole Peoples make a reference to Near St. Nick, who was a figure in the organ harvesting cult. And then there are there's a direct reference to it in possibly one of my favorite episodes that I've written, The Exclusion Day Carol. Which, again, is sort of my love letter to Caligari. But they mention Adele Lazarus, who was having an organ harvesting cult until they found out and ripped her to shreds.
Yeah. So my only regret is that didn't become part of the main story, which is, once again, it's not like I'm very happy with what sort of happened. But I was kind of like, oh, I kind of wish that idea had gone somewhere. But I do also, I hear Jim talk about the, like, Animaniacs versus Battlestar Galactica, I feel like that's pulling it from an even darker region that, may or may not make sense. But I always kind of like,
from Repo.
So what, and I hope that, like, some new audio drama producers are listening to this, because I can say that after 8 seasons, and really 9 seasons, because we did season 1 twice, 9 seasons of producing this show, only at this very last time have I successfully figured out a system for tracking recordings and scheduling recordings efficiently. And it happened this time, and it worked. And it took me so many years and so much heartache and so much patience.
Is this the entire reason we're doing a second show after this? Just yes. So you can keep yes, using
absolutely.
That system?
So I can organize it.
Yeah, okay, great.
Like, I mean, Our Fair City, fans often comment on how big and sprawling and extensive it is. And let me tell you, when you are corralling, when you are processing schedules of that many actors who are so damn talented that they get cast in everything, coordinating, 20 plus 30 schedules of people, and making sure that as things get refined, that you have all the right people on the right days, and inevitably you don't. Like, only in this last year did I find what was really, I think, a foolproof schedule, and only one person was called once for a day that they didn't need to be there. And,
that's a win.
So, like, boy, if it, the only, like, maybe the only regret I have is that I didn't find that earlier. And I only found it through blood, sweat, lots of tears, post-it notes, and printed out Excel sheets spread all over my entire apartment, learning from the amazing organizer that is Betsy Palmer, who did a few seasons of scheduling and now runs all the live events, and is one of the most organized and talented people I know. Also, my partner for, one of my partners for full disclosure.
But I'll second. She's pretty damn good at a spreadsheet.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I could never do what Betsy does.
I like to imagine that it involves stick pins with red thread
strung
amongst them, like you're trying to solve a murder.
Oh, yeah.
We create string rooms, yeah. And so if you're out there producing and you're finding that part to be a headache, like, you're not bad at this. This is really hard. And so give yourself a break.
I have no regrets.
Amen.
Amen, sister.
It's so interesting, and I've said this, to friends, I know I've said to you, that as an actor working on the show, primarily only as an actor, it's so different from the acting experience as in a play, where
retakes.
But also like I was saying before, I'm sort of in just the middle part of this process, and so by the time the finished product is released out into the world, first of all, it's probably been 6 months since I've said the lines out loud, and And so I get to listen to it with surprise and delight. And I haven't heard all of the, you know, I heard it the read through, but the episodes changed so much that, like, if I'm not in an episode, I won't have heard it for a year before I hear it as a final product. So it's really like I just get to be a part of this thing that I am a fan of. And, you know, you go into the recording studio and you kind of do it however you want a few times, and then somebody else gets to decide which one to use. So it's a very, like, I have no regrets.
That's awesome. Nice. Cool.
My favorite part of that is listening to my friends who are, like, just joining the show late or at certain points, mm-hmm. but listening to them comment on things that I recorded years ago. And then making – it just gives me this like, great sense of nostalgia to hear about, like, someone else's, like, visceral emotional reaction to, like, you know, when –
like this
when,
thing that happened in yes, Clayton's apartment 5 years ago.
Yes. Right, I remember doing the recording and remember what the recording was like. And the recording was like, you know, Clayton, like, shaking me so I can get the right physical sound out of it. Or you know, like – you know, Ellie and I, like, staring at each other and emoting across the microphones that gets completely lost by an audio drama, right? But it doesn't
but
get
it doesn't.
Lost.
But yeah,
that's
it
the
does.
Thing. It
got us where we needed to be to have a vocal performance.
It did. It doesn't get lost when I hear one of my friends saying, like, oh, my God, I listened to episode this and whatever and, you know.
Yeah.
That's cool because it's something that I'm so used to theater where – You're literally looking at your audience and gauging your audience's reaction and changing your performance based on your audience.
And it's so freeing to be just at the mic with a safe group of people. The room that Jeffrey and Clayton and the writers have cultivated is a really safe and exciting place to experiment. And not only is there the opportunity for retakes, but you don't have to worry about being pretty when you're delivering your lines. Like, you can put yourself in whatever ridiculous posture you need to get the right sounds for what is happening to your character in a way that is just, it's so different from stage work in a way that's freeing in a way I had never experienced before working with this crew.
Okay, Catnip, I have a really important question for you.
Yes,
this comes from Snail Army, who wants to know if you will be their mentor / older sibling / parent. Note, I'm not high maintenance, I promise.
That's amazing. And I squeed so hard when I read that question. I will totally say that I'm an only child and I'm absolutely accepting applications for siblings.
Great.
I've always wanted one.
Oh.
Super.
Yes.
send those to info@ourfaircity.com.
So there are two questions that are very similar. There's one from Diplus Goodful.
Double plus good. It's from 1984.
As I said, Diplus Goodful on Twitter.
It's French.
C'est pas français.
Dear supervisor at OFC Radio, as a new policy, I've caught up on all the episodes from the Department of Memory. What do I do now? Which I feel we've discussed that. However, there's also – oh, here it is. It's Jervis Tech 7 is trying to create a movie trailer using clips and visuals from various media for Our Fair City. And he's looking – or he, she, they
–
person is looking for some visuals, some sources to draw from, some visual media that might inspire – what maybe served as inspiration in making Our Fair City.
Oh, okay. So, first of all, Brazil and 12 Monkeys, absolutely.
Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer, yeah, absolutely.
Is it weird that what I think of is Tank Girl?
Oh,
no, not at all.
Absolutely, yeah. So here's, this is cheating, kind of, but Palladium's role-playing game from the 90s, Rifts, is an excellent is one of the places where I have always pulled, like, visual inspiration in the terms of, like, mashing up, like, really clean shiny chrome and, like, grungy awful stuff.
Could you get any more postmodern?
Right. Gosh.
I would also say City of Lost Children and Delicatessen.
Oh,
two Jean-Pierre Genet movies from the early to late 90s.
Delicatessen,
I guess 90s
is
how you call,
like,
that.
is the horror, is the funny horror end of Our Fair City. Like, any time where there's been a sound effect that you'd be like, oh!
Which means about every three episodes.
Yeah. Like, Delicatessen is a great place to draw a lot of that from. Funnily enough, the director made Amelie.
Yes.
So, like, that's a weird juxtaposition.
Amelie was his first film without the art designer Marc Carroll involved in any of his work. So you gotta imagine that if Genet was the levity of that relationship, what would one of Marc Carroll's films on his own look like?
Ooh, woof.
It's like the inside of a butcher bag.
So I think this might be an interesting place to bring this question up. So Marsha and I once at one point had a long conversation about how if you were going to make the film or TV version of the show.
Like the Netflix original series.
Would...
I would cast myself. Fuck you, famous people.
Explicit tag.
Would...
Sorry,
would,
explicit tag twice. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
I'm not going to go into the fact that we'd cast the whole show, because that's a, like a whole other episode. But specifically, how would you handle the moles? Would they be CGI? Would they be practical effects? Would they be animation a la Roger Rabbit? We may have talked about this for like an hour.
I would want practical effects. I would want Jim Henson puppets.
I'm totally with you there.
Yeah, that might totally be like generational.
I feel like, but there's also like there is some of this, there's some of our world that lives in the same place as Doctor Who, like the reboot, in terms of it's like living on the Galactica Animaniacs spectrum, and so.
I still find practical effects better.
Right, that's why I would support a practical effect.
So that
effect
would be more like actors in makeup than Muppets.
Well, Farscape Muppets. Farscape.
I feel like you could also make an argument, and this, again, is probably generational, but depending on how much levity or darkness, like how deep into the uncanny valley you wanted the mole people to live, I kind of would like to see a treatment of them using stop motion animation, like Ray Harryhausen, or
that's what I pictured for the meat wall.
Jens Venkmeyer's kind of work.
Harryhausen meat wall, completely.
Yeah,
maybe, and the ant people.
Maybe that's a good way of
all
looking at that.
Ant people are all, you know, xylophone skeleton style.
Oh yeah, because that's like when I think claymation, I think Large Marge. And
Oh my god, that
the gnomes from Return to Oz, and those were movies that scared the crap out of me when I was younger.
I love stop motion.
So yeah. The other option would be doing it kind of like rotoscope style.
Yeah.
But I feel like that would indicate they are otherworldly. Well, I think if I were gonna rotoscope anything, I might like.
What do you mean rotoscope?
Tracing
over cellular animation.
Yeah.
Waking life.
The old-fashioned Lord of the Rings movie.
Yeah. Not the Peter Jackson one.
Or I might.
Well, Ralph Bakshi, not Rankin and Bass.
Yeah.
I think the only thing I would rotoscope in that way, and it would never be explained, but I would rotoscope Chamberlain at every moment he was on screen. And just leave that sitting there for the audience to go.
What is that about?
Because he's otherworldly.
Just leave that in there and just like.
Sorry, I was going to jump in and say, if anyone out there has read any of the John Dies at the End book series by David Wong, like I'd imagine Chamberlain and the Shadow People being of a piece together. Like you could probably do that in the same way.
Also good stuff.
Yeah.
Vrak on Tumblr asks, first says, thank you so much for all the hard work. And
you're
for-
welcome.
Thanks, Jim. And for holding together as Our Fair City becomes ever more frighteningly prescient. As writers or performers, what was the most surprising change over the course of the show, either in plot events or production?
For me, it's been how frighteningly prescient it's become. We actually... Jeffrey Clayton and I had to have were having a conversation just a few days ago about the I'm going to be spoiler free, but we were talking about the ending of the series and trying to figure out what tone we wanted to hit with how to end it because of the current political situation. And, like, do we go full on, like, didactic message? Do we try and give our listeners who maybe, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are having a hard time because of what's going on now. Like, do we try and give them a little bit more catharsis? Like, how do we do that? And that's something we never thought we'd have to deal with. I know I never thought I'd have to, like, have to deal with it. I just wanted to write a silly show where people's heads get cut off and stuck on spider legs. So,
yeah, that's been a tricky conversation for a lot of creators, especially in our community right now. I'm going to shoehorn in plug the other community that I belong to here in Chicago is a theater company dedicated to putting horror on stage, Wild Claw Theater. And one of the conversations we've been having over the past several months have been about what our responsibility is to our community as practitioners of horror storytelling in legitimately scary times, whether or not it's incumbent on us to provide escape for our audience or catharsis to our audience in the form of arming them for real world parallels to the stories we're choosing to tell. So that's sobering.
On a lighter note, I think, you know, three characters that I don't think, I certainly didn't think were going to become as central to the story were Andrew, Dr. Weston Caligari.
Really?
Yeah, I think Andrew really grew from a kind of a side character to, you know, one of the main characters of the show. Caligari from kind of a villain or an antagonist into, you know, one of the
hero.
A key protagonist.
Of every season. is that what you were going to say?
Remember, in the original season, Nathan was the hero.
Yeah.
Right, and he's a tool.
Yeah.
There
was also another question on which characters we would like to kill, and the answer is Nathan.
Nathan. I'm gonna back that up. Nathan.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I feel the same way. Again, I'm going to gush about Caligari now. Going from a place of not having a good handle on, like, who the character was and, like, really not being sure, like, really not liking the character because we didn't have a good handle on who she was or what we were going to do.
That might have been my fault.
But then, like, and then Marcia came in and having her voice and being like, oh, okay, this is who the character is. And then, like, me personally feeling, like, really invested in the character because I'm like, I'm going to put everything that I am into Caligari. She has trouble making friends. I have trouble making friends. Here you go. So, yeah, like, because originally everyone's favorite was West. Like, in my opinion, like, everyone loved West. West was the wacky, crazy guy. And then, like, and he was my favorite. And then slowly that changed. And then, like, now Caligari's my favorite character in the entire series.
I have a question for you then, yes. Jim. Do you go up elevators the hard way? Is that something Caligari gets from you?
No. Oh. So real quick, I'm going to do a slight plug. If you are terribly missing Our Fair City and just can't handle the wait for season 8, check out some of our comics in our store. We have 5 or 6 of them. We have a number of them with writers and artists, both locally, some who sent their stuff in to us. Check those out to continue the story of Our Fair City. Also, check out some friends of the show who also have podcasts and radio shows. Check out ARS Paradoxica. The Bright Sessions is really good. Wolf 359. If you're looking for something a bit spooky but a bit more realistic, Blurry Photos is great. I love those guys. Also, Spirits Podcast. I love those girls. Also, Mark Soloff has a show called Blaster Podcast. Check that out with his roommate Dottore Bilordo. Also, check out Alcohollywood, our friends Jared and Clint drink and talk about movies, and occasionally Ellie's on.
Speaking to all the possible audio drama creators out there, if you're interested in writing a short horror audio drama, I would love to hear from you with Wildclaw Theater. You can go to wildclawtheater.com. That's theater with an R-E, because we are now taking submissions for our 10th annual Death Scribe, the International Festival of Audio Horror. This is a competition that we produce yearly, and we take the top five, our five favorite scary stories in an audio drama format, and we perform them live. We'll be at Lincoln Hall this year, this December 4th. It's the first Monday in December, and you can see your script performed by some of the best actors in town, backed by a full band and a table full of Foley artists. So again, go to wildclawtheater.com for information on submitting. You have until July 31st, and I want you to scare me. And hey, Jim, where can we find Ansel Birch this time of year?
This time of year, you can find him doing Starlight Radio Dreams here in Chicago. You can also find him on the internet doing the recordings of Starlight Radio Dreams.
Also featuring Kat Evans.
Yeah, she's Lomi. And the Time Traveler and Dora and all sorts of people. And then when it's not this time of year, you can find Ansel at the Bristol Renaissance Fair with all of his friends.
We know too many talented people.
Yeah, we do.
That's There's really the long and the short of this, yeah. Uh-huh.
We live in the best
days. And then I think we're good. Thank you all so much. That was great. I certainly learned a bunch of things that I didn't know, so I'm thrilled. Thanks for coming out and answering questions with me.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.